ask the members to take their seats. This evening we have several folks here to testify. Terry Lydell, who spoke with us before, will start us off and give us kind of an intro to the discussion we're going to have this evening. And then we've asked Wayne Jennings, former principal of the St. Paul Open School, to give us a little information about brain development and innovative teaching methods. And then we have representatives from the Department of Education, Gloria Kibble and Marceline here to talk to us, to give answers to the questions. You may remember we gave them a long list of questions that we wanted to find out about alternative education and alternative programs in the state of Minnesota. And then we have three directors from programs coming to give a little more background to the answers of the questions that we'll hear from the department. And then we also have Cheryl Lang, who has done some extensive research into alternative programs, to give us some information at the end of the program. Just want to thank you again, members, for being willing to sit on this work group and enjoy working with you. We will need to set the date for our next meeting, and I think we hope to send out an email to you with some suggestions and didn't get that to you in a timely manner. So we probably will do that by email, and we'll let interested parties know as well when the next meeting is, when you all have your calendars with you. Before we get started, do any of you have any thoughts or questions you'd like to share at this time? All right. Okay. Then I'll explain. We're going to have the testifiers come up to the other side of the table here. It seemed a little bit far away, distant to have them down there, and we're not sure those two microphones are working. So, if you'd like to start us off, Terry Lydell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. My name is Terry Lydell, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Association of Alternative Programs. And I wanted to start off by bringing up a few key points that we could keep in mind for tonight and as we go forward on this question of multiple measures. First of all, we believe that accountability is required. We do not seek to avoid accountability. Instead, the accountability we seek through multiple measures will be more exacting than the present system of high-stakes tests, less damaging to students, and offer proven methods to continuously improve schools and therefore student success. We are asking for a more accurate and telling work, not less work. The criteria are paramount to understanding where we are coming from, and that's on the goal sheet of paper that you have in your packet. To understand the request for multiple measures, it is very important to understand the criteria that place students in area learning centers and charter schools that choose to work with this student population. The criteria state very specific debilitating conditions that interfere with the student's learning: mental illness, physical and sexual trauma, drug addiction, and so on. Brain-based research tells us that such conditions need to be addressed before meaningful learning can take place. Most times this takes more than the usual school year provides, and many times takes longer than the traditional 12 years of schooling. Additionally, there is an interesting legal quandary to consider when we look at criteria established by Minnesota Statute 124D.68 and the requirements of No Child Left Behind law. One of the considerations of a good law is that it does not contradict another law. However, one of the Minnesota criteria is that a student, quote, performs substantially below the performance level for pupils of the same age in a locally determined achievement test. Yet, according to NCLB, the student's progress is measured by a high-stakes test. This is a little like asking a person to single-handedly pick up a small automobile, and when he demonstrates he can't do that, turn around and ask him to pick up a Hummer or a Sherman tank. Now, surely we can help get students to the level where they can be ready to take high-stakes tests, but that takes time and data for us to plan and execute proper interventions. We hope you would be aware of leading and lagging indicators. High-stakes tests are lagging indicators. They occur after all the work has been done and a final report and give a final report of the results. They do not provide any detail to determine what interventions worked or did not work. Multiple measures are leading or formative indicators. Knowing where the student has been or is at now will give some idea of what interventions need to take place. If a school notices an uptick in the number of students suffering from mental illnesses, they can assess their capacity to address these issues and impact strategies and implement strategies like securing outside resources or increasing staff development. Multiple measures are not just simply more tests. They instead are the collection of data points from which a school can build facts, information, and knowledge. Leading indicators can help predict and change lagging indicators, and therefore they possess greater power. I want you to be aware of best practice. We hope you will be cautious when you hear the term best practice. In the area of quality management, best practice is a special term. Best means that it is better than all the others, and that is determined by data that proves it to be best. Data of this sort is very rare, if it exists at all, in education. Therefore, it is dangerous to call a school a best practice school. Add to this that we live in a world that is changing at the speed of a rocket, and a program that is best practice today may not be best practice tomorrow. Even if we identify a best practice school, we must remember that even best practices are not plug compatible from one school to another. It takes detailed analysis to determine if what works in one school will work in another. The ultimate best practice is homegrown. That's by building a school vision and intervention from the ground up, and that will call for multiple measures. Minnesota is not alone. We know through our work with the International Association of Learning Alternatives and the research that you will hear tonight from Dr. Cheryl Lang, we know that Minnesota is not alone in having students that face troubling circumstances in their life that interfere with learning. We appreciate and we are eager to work with this legislative work group to address the needs of Minnesota students that need extra assistance to succeed. Together we can create an educational process that will again put Minnesota in the forefront of a nation in matters that relate to education. We hope you express your concerns and ask probing questions and insist on continuing this work because, as Arvon Fraser said, we only get one chance to educate our children. That concludes my remarks, Mr. Chair.
Does anyone have any questions or comments? I'll just note that in your packets you do have Ms. Lydell's testimony as well as a copy of the statute that defines the criteria for admission to.
And also a copy of our 2003 position statement on multiple measures. Thank you.
I'll call upon Dr. Jennings.
Thank you, Representative Blyne, and other members of the task force. I would like to talk to you just for a little bit about this idea of what's called brain-based or brain-compatible learning and its impact on the kinds of students that we serve on alternative programs. Just by way of background, I am a member of the MAP, ex-official member of the MAP board, and I also was involved in starting a very early alternative school in St. Paul. Even predated St. Paul Open School, started in 1969. I was thinking back to that school. We were located, it was part of St. Paul schools, and high schools had kids they didn't know what to do with, and so the district decided to start this program called Career Study Center. It was located in the train depot because space was so scarce. We rented space there, or at least a joke. Our job was to get these kids back on the track. Learning. A student came to us from Highland Park Senior High School, and he was a student who was doing well in school, but he just hated the structure of the school. It felt it was hemming him in and preventing him from learning the kinds of things he wanted to learn. Most of our kids were having a lot of problems in school. He wasn't, but he just was rebelling against the structure. So we asked him what he wanted to learn, and he said he wanted to study New Age music. So we said, well, let's see how can we facilitate that. So he said, well, I'd have to study that out in California. He said, that's where the center is for doing that. So with his parents' permission, we allowed him to go out there and to send us a report each week. He graduated
just fine, and he went on into the world. You'll know his name, perhaps, if I mention it. Rich Forstin. He's been a music director for Prairie Home Companion for all these years, which is something to say, having survived, you know, the numerous turnovers with Garrison's program. In your packet, I gave you just a kind of three pages that I won't go over, but just to kind of summarize, having to do with this idea of brain-based learning. There's been a lot of study about the human brain in just the last recent decades, coming out of the field of medicine and, of course, neurology and cognitive studies and so on. And we were trying to figure out over the years what are the applications of that knowledge for learning and for schools and for teaching and helping kids to get more out of school. What we've discovered is that some of the things we do in school is incompatible with how the brain functions. And some of the things we do in school is compatible. And the complexity of that, what might be incompatible for this student is not incompatible for that student, so it makes the teacher's job quite demanding. One of the references that I just wanted to mention is a book called How People Learn, Brain, Mind, Experience in School. This comes from probably the most prestigious scientific group in the country, the National Academy, which serves the United States Congress and the nation for taking a look at particular subjects and preparing descriptions of, in this case, how people learn. One of the things we know, there's sort of three facets that we now pretty well understand, and of course these are things that really gifted teachers will probably always have known, common sense approach. But we understand now that the brain likes a safe, secure setting. If students are under anxiety, stress, having a lot of problems, their mind and their brain isn't really as open to learning. They're just, they're busy fighting off, or they're tormented, or in some way the brain isn't fully open to learning. And so we now know that the setting has to be reasonably safe and secure, where the student feels respected and liked. Where those conditions aren't true, then learning isn't going to proceed very fast. And for many of the students that we serve in alternative programs, they do have those troubling kinds of problems, long failure perhaps, maybe problems at home, maybe all kinds of problems that get in the way. There may be mental health, there may be substance abuse problems, and so on. And as a result, they're not at their best for learning, and they often fail in school, and somebody has to try to pick up those pieces. We know that students, that the brain likes lots of input. It really rebels if things are boring. I remember a student that I had in an alternative school years ago, and this student wasn't interested in school at all, but what she was interested in was horses. And that was her driving kind of interest. That was all she was interested in. And so I happened to be her advisor, and I was trying to get her to have a balanced program and to pay attention to mathematics and the other subjects in the curriculum, but she just wouldn't. All she did was interested in horses. So I began to ask her one day, you know, what was she learning from that? And she said, I'm learning everything about horses. And I thought to myself, well, I think I'll quiz her about that. And I didn't quite know what even to ask her. So I asked her, there are different breeds of horses and so on. She said, oh, yes. I said, well, what are some of them? And she must have given me at least 20, as well as their country of origin as well. And I said, oh, there's diseases that horses have. And she began to give me all of those as well. So what we did is we tried then to try to integrate her learning other kinds of things. She was obviously learning some science and some biology and some geography through all of this, as sort of an integrated form of learning. That's one of the things the brain likes, is a lot of input. And she was getting it, wasn't getting it from us in the school necessarily. We were just trying to make it possible so that she could learn. Students, the brain also likes opportunities for active learning, to do things. And that creates a lot of problems for kids in school, because much of, especially secondary school, is sitting in classes and, hearing the teacher talk, reciting, perhaps reading a book. And for many kids, they like more active kinds of things, being able to do something. Active doesn't always mean with the hands, it could mean active with the mind as well.
but actually accomplishing something, seeing some end result, seeing something come out of it, build something, make something, perform something. Brain likes that. If it's cooped, it almost feels cooped up if it doesn't have the opportunity to do that, and you get that rebellion on your hands that we had with Rich. And finally, the brain likes feedback. It needs feedback for correction. Let me give you an example of that. A 3-year-old says, "Mommy, Bobby hit at me." Now, assuming the home speaks correct English, the child has never heard "hit at," but the brain has extracted the ed ending or the past tense ending and provided it on an irregular verb. It's quite a feat of the brain if you think about that a little bit. Mom says, "Then you mean hit?" And the kid says, "Huh?" But after a couple instances of that, the brain automatically corrects it. It's gotten feedback. If someone has said, you know, "You mean hip," it would have been useless to give a lesson on the past tense verb for that child. But that's the brain's ability to extract information and to form its own patterns. So we're learning a lot about how that all works. So for the students who are in alternative programs, I think we're doing time to prepare training in this area. In fact, I have training for the Crossroads Alternative School next Monday. There's half months of information on how they can apply this. And we do training at their conferences and so on. I've been at this for quite a while. It's been a particular passion of mine. I have a newsletter that we've been doing for 18 years on this particular topic of how we apply the new knowledge about brain-based learning. So that's just a little bit of an overview, and I left kind of a quick summary with you about this particular topic. But at any rate, we know that the students who qualify for alternative programs under HSDI must have a safe setting. And I think what happens in these alternative settings is that they're smaller, the student is known, the program is more personalized and individualized, and thus there's a possibility of reducing that stress and anxiety and opening the brain to learning. It's an opportunity to individualize the instruction. And I think that also means, in terms of multiple assessments, it means different ways to go about assessing the knowledge that students are gaining. We now know that only about 20% of all the students are well suited to conventional school instruction. This is from Howard Gardner at Harvard University, an expert on human intelligence. That leaves 80% of the students at various stages of discomfort, from total discomfort to somewhat discomfortable. But the reason for alternatives and why we have to have more than one way. One size doesn't work for all, and I guess we all understand that. And that's kind of a quick sense of this particular topic.
Does anyone have any questions they'd like to ask?
A quick question. I heard something there about, about time. Is there an issue here in terms of the dominant system expecting certain learning to happen within a certain time setting? So maybe just say a little bit about how important that is, or is really the gist of your presentation here, less about that and just more about different.
It's a very I think if I understand your question, are there certain times when certain kinds of learning is going to occur, or when students are ready to learn? Are you asking about that?
And what I'm getting to is, you know, are we setting ourselves up for potential issues if we're expecting that every cohort of students is going to need to accomplish competency within a certain time?
Well, the time for learning varies enormously. For example, the beginning age for reading runs from 3 to 12, and yet we always want our own start at age 5 or 6. So it means that students who aren't ready, in spite of what we do, their brains may not be quite ready for that. It's like one size fits all again. I don't know if I'm addressing your question. I had a student I remember that I got to know quite well. We had a magic club in our school. And this kid was brilliant and And I asked him a little bit about what his elementary school was like. He said it was awful. I said, why? So he said, I didn't learn to read until I was age six. Until sixth grade. I said, well, how'd you get by? He said, well, I just faked it, but he says, I was always in terror. Because when I finally learned it, when he was in the sixth grade, he said, then I made progress very rapidly. So I'm not sure I'm getting at what you're asking about, but there are those sort of frames for when we're more open to learning certain kinds of things. And that's one reason why people question our standard age-graded school system, because it fits for maybe, the middle 50% of the kids, but the kids on the other edges are much faster than that, and on the other end are slower than that, are not ready for that, and so it's better if we can somehow individualize the learning and move at the student's own pace. When we do that, the studies show that kids learn faster and better, and there's less anxiety and less failure.
I wonder, can you provide us the story from that Harvard study of the 20% comfort?
Howard Gardner.
Howard Gardner. Howard Gardner.
No, Howard Gardner. He's from Harvard, yes. He had a book called Frames of Intelligence.
Thank you.
Frames of Mind, maybe.
Frames of Mind, yeah.
Frames of Mind.
Good copy. Any other questions for Dr. Jennings?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very informative. All right, I think we have some members from the department to come up and address the questions that we gave you last time. Introduce yourself.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gloria Kibble. I am currently the supervisor on school choice and supervise various school choice programs like the alternative programs at the Minnesota Department of Education. But more than that, I was the alternative program specialist at the department for several years before I became the supervisor. So MD is very excited to be able to respond to your questions. We welcome all of them. That today we met some time with people from IT and program finance to kind of call through what we can and can't give you, and some of that will be in the questions. So I thought the best way, if you'd like me to, is just to start with the questions that you've posed, and we actually have three sets that have come at different times, so we've put them together. I will refer to the document that's got the heading on it with the date October 23rd. And I'll just start with number one.
Okay.
Go through. Much of this you've already heard when Dr. Jennings was just talking about when he referred to the high school, the graduation incentive criteria, it's the 12 criteria. Every student has to meet one of the 12 in order to attend an alternative program. In the bottom here, this was some data we were able to get for you. That if you're looking at the last four bullets, there was a question about what are the demographics of the students, and you can see 48% of the students are students of color, and the breakdown is 3% American Indian, 11% Asian, 12% Hispanic, 20% black, and then 52% are white. Obviously, this is a statewide perspective. 11% are receiving special education services. Interestingly, of the 12 criteria and the graduation incentives that are listed in statute, special ed is not one of them. But that doesn't mean that that alternative programs don't serve the needs of students with that need special ed.
Yes, Representative Driving.
Thank you. One of the questions that I wasn't at the beginning of the meeting last time, so maybe this does answer the question, but my question last time was that the 150,000 students that we hear are in alternative programs, it was discussed that they weren't all full-time. And so this 149,006 students, how many of them are
full-time? Mr. Chair, Representative Grayling, we have those figures for you. So if you're okay, it's a couple questions. But that is a very important question, so I will address that.
Thank you.
40% are eligible for free or reduced price lunch. I just have to tell you from my experience what I've heard, this number is low. A lot of the students feel that they're not going to eat lunch that they don't need to fill out the form, which of course there's not necessarily a relationship between filling out the form and lunch. So that number is higher when students are sometimes reluctant. And then of gender, 46% are female and 50% are male. Second question was what current data is available. Attendance is easy to get. The MCA scores, as you see, I'll go through the actual difference in the MCA scores between the traditional population and students that attend a state-approved alternative program. The numbers of students by age, grade, ethnicity, free and reduced lunch, gender, special education status. And we could do that again by grade and by gender. We could break that down. Start and end date. So we could, but we'd have to look at that by program, but we do. We could tell you how much time a student spends in a program, but again, that would have, we'd have to look at that by program, something. Number three, and please do interrupt if you have any questions. I know I'm going through this kind of rapidly. How long do students remain in state-approved alternative programs? We don't have that data. We don't know. We don't have a way right now of looking at it from year to year. It's not uncommon that a student would spend their whole high school career in a state-approved alternative program. At the same time, it's not unlikely a student would come and make up one credit if they need to get ahead. But again, if you wanted us to do some sampling of programs, we could do that.
Yes, sure.
Definitely.
Thank you. Ms. Kibble, this does get to a question that was just forming in my mind about perhaps it's a question of what is the population breakdown of students. With Dr. Jennings' testimony, it's clear there are some students who simply are not going to be successful in a traditional setting. And an alternative setting is where they can best experience success. If you look at the criteria for admission into an alternative program, other students may be in there on a more transitory nature, come in after going through chemical dependency treatment, and may not need to be there for 4 years in order to find the stability and safety that they need using Dr. Jennings' criteria. Which leads me to kind of raise the question, clumsily, what's the goal? Is the goal to assist students in adjusting, assist students in making up lost academic time, credits, knowledge, and then try to return them to the mainstream, or is it to set up a more parallel education system from the mainstream? Can you respond to that clumsy question?
No, that's right. Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, that's an interesting question, and the answer is both. Over here you have a faction where I get to the numbers of students who come to make up only one or two or three credits and get caught up. Those are typically the students we refer to as dual enrolled. They stay in the traditional system during the day, and then they come to the alternative program in the evenings, summers, sometimes weekends, but they're making up credits. But primarily it's just what you were talking about, they want to get caught up. The second is what you referred to as the parallel system. We found this, and Dr. Jennings talked to this. One of the key components of alternative programs in the state of Minnesota is that relationship building. When the students come there and they've come and they've had difficulty in the traditional system, and all of a sudden they come into this environment where their learning style is accepted, somebody actually personalizes it for them, they feel like they're making great strides, they're not going to leave that system. So typically a student who comes in there as a full-time student because it is meeting their individual needs will stay in that system. That's a good question. Number four, is there any tracking of information about what happens after they leave? No, we do not have one. I think years ago, many, many years ago, I think that there was some money that we did look at what happened after high school, but that has not happened for many years. Number five, how many students served by SAPS are chemically dependent? We have some programs that are sober schools. In fact, you have a representative here from Oakland Area Learning Center who started a sober school about 3 years ago. It's White Bear Lake also has one. It's not uncommon that an alternative program would have a program that for sobriety or for chemical dependency, but there isn't a way in Mars tracking right now that it measures if they're in the chemical dependency part or in the alternative program. Some of them have that, but we don't have any true numbers for that. I can say there are several charter schools that have, like Sobriety High, specifically have the focus of silver schools, and that those numbers you could have. But if I were to make a generalization, the silver school, the need for silver schools is growing. There's more and more a need to, once a student has gone through treatment, not to return them to their environment, but have an environment that's more nurturing and focuses on variety. Number six, how many students served by SAPS are also dealing with mental illness? Reportedly by programs, there's many, many of them. Again, they're not tracked in MARS reporting. When a student, when a school district enters a student into the MARS system, they enter them as being an area learning center, but not why they're there. So we don't have any data. However, if you went to specific programs, they would be able to give you that information. Number seven, how many students are in ALCs or ALPs and attend summer school? For FY06, and this really was surprised at, and we worked quite a while today with data management and IT on this, 48,266 students were in summer school. These were the, well, I shouldn't say in summer school, these were the students that had a record sometime in the MARS system in June, July, or August. So assuming they had that record, it assumes that they were in school at some time. Now you compare that to the total students of 60,000. It was a very high percentage, obviously. So, okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I'm wondering if there is necessarily a correlation between students who are in summer school and students who are in alternative programs, and except that they have to enroll in the program to take summer school. So it's a difficult number to get a handle on, I guess what I'm trying to say. Is that correct? Or?
That is correct, Representative Black. It could be the students. A lot of students are in it only during the summer to make up credits. But it just shows the need for a program during the summer and funding to flow to the programs so that they have the funding to pay the teachers so that we can get these kids caught up. One of the reasons that we have the graduation rate that we do in the state of Minnesota and that we've been so successful is because we have some funding for after school and summer programming. But this was higher than I would have expected. But it shows that we're serving a lot of students during the summer. But you're right, they could be just there during the summer.
So, Mr. Chair, just so I'm tracking, the 50,000 figure that is the ALC or ALP total community, is that?
Representative Bright and Representative Mariano, that's correct. It's all of them. It's actually all three categories: area learning centers, alternative ALPs for alternative learning programs, and contract alternatives.
And so just to back up, and I apologize for being so basic here, but the 149,000 on the previous page, that...
Okay, I might...
Why don't you go ahead and explain that? So the breakdown between 149,000 targeted services and then the high school, that might be helpful to explain that now.
Representative Bly, if you have your PowerPoint, I believe that this was handed out last. You've got a copy of this?
Could there be a question that Representative Brown is trying to raise?
Oh,
yes, it is.
Well, we're still getting to that.
Right.
Yeah.
I can wait.
Okay. Well, no, this is working. Well, yeah,
I think it would be good to just
wait until
you want to wait. All right.
If it's okay, I'll
just
wait. Okay. Follow up the same
thing. Right.
Yeah, it's a big question.
Yeah, right. Go ahead,
Alex. Well, members of the committee, I'll start big and I'll come down to the small.
Just, you know, that will become clear.
I promise. Number eight. This is by far not the exhausted list of great alternative programs for AL Learning Centers, but we did list some here that if you're interested in seeing some, including Northfield ALC, that we would suggest that you go visit. On the next page, the question was what characteristics or what are the elements that are important in a successful alternative program? This is very similar. In fact, Dr. Jennings' testimony was a good segue into this. But it's that caring relationship, that individualization, that ability to be able to do hands-on learning with the students. A lot of students in alternative programs are very tactile. They need hands-on, so it makes it more difficult when they're in a traditional classroom, sitting in a class with somebody stealing information of them. But those are the elements that we would consider that the schools that we've listed, most of the schools in the state would have. Number nine, what is the relationship between ALPs and traditional public schools? You had some information also that was handed out last time that actually it's in this PowerPoint, and we'll go through it. The difference between the ALP and the ALC, I believe, is in here. It's also listed on, the elements are listed under nine. Basically, the difference is ALPs are smaller, tied closer to the school district, and area learning center broader, it serves more than one district. ALCs also serve a K-12 population. Typically, an ALP will only serve a small population in a high school. Small communities, I'm thinking of Ada, Minnesota, Pipestone, Minnesota, have small ALPs where they serve, they want to do credit recovery for their students. Number 10, what difficulties or unique situations are encountered when attempting to evaluate ALCs? Obviously, the mobility of the students. When I was meeting with IT today, they had pulled one of the students' records, and they had found that that student had been in four schools in 1 year. They'd been in a charter school, they'd been in two traditional schools, and they'd been in an alternative program. The state tests fail to measure individual student progress. As we'll talk about when you look at the student scores and how the alternative program scores compared to the traditional school scores, it's not that the students can't do it, it's just they come behind, so they're behind. So the state tests only measure if they're up to where they need to be. It doesn't show what growth they have. School size, many are small schools. Each program is unique and meet the needs of the district population. It's difficult to have one set of evaluation criteria because of this, because of the uniqueness. Obviously, Red Lake, Minnesota has an area learning center, as does Pipestone. They have a small ALP, but they're very different. And programs tend to be community-based and reflect the community that they serve, which contributes to their uniqueness. When you hear Fred Easter talk about City Inc., you'll see that. That's a very community-based school. Number 11, how are state-approved alternative programs currently functioning and how can they be improved? Again, they're all very different, very unique. Each one does an application and they're approved on that application for that particular community. Most are very strong and meet the needs of their students. And then again, have a focus on credit makeup. I talked about this before. Minnesota is recognized for its structure for alternative programs, and certainly a contributor to the fact that we have a high graduation rate in the state of Minnesota. The Minnesota Association of Alternative Programs, you heard Terry Lydell talk, is a strong organization that we work with. The area most concerned, if we were talking about one area of concern, that there probably isn't as much that we think is the independent study, and that varies from as far as rigor, the student-teacher contact time, the curriculum, pedagogy. Improvement of the independent study component of alternative education would be an improvement for all of alternative education. That's not saying that there aren't some alternative education programs, independent study programs that are done extremely well. You've got an example here with Oakland Area Learning Center, but that is one area that, because they do, that seems to vary between many of the alternative programs. Measuring educational outcomes, what's the difference? On the MCAT tools, alternative education students' scores are lower, and if you will refer to the handout you have, the chart, and it's 2000 assessment results statewide and alternative learning education sites. Yep. On the left, you have basically the students in traditional programs. On the white quadrant, on the right side, on the right quadrant, you have the ALC. So if I can, I'll just walk you through it. And let's look at the 10th grade reading and 11th grade math at the very bottom, on the very left-hand side. But before we do that, if you go to the top, the count, the level D, the level P, the level M, the level E. M is the student net standards. D is the exceeded standard. So if you draw a line, if that was 4, and you draw a line halfway down it between the two, the D and P being on one side and the M and E being on the other side, the M and E are the students that will have considered passing the test, the DNP with the students that did not. The D is for does not meet standards, P is partially meet standards, M is met, and E is exceeded. So let's look at the 10th grade reading. If you look at the 10th grade reading, and you look at the 62%, the percent of statewide students who meet or exceed standards, 62% of the students in 10th grade who took the reading test in the traditional school met or exceeded the standards. If you move over to the ALC count, you'll see that number at 16%. So there's a significant difference. It's not that students can't do it, it's just that they're behind. Going down then with the math, 32% of the students in the traditional schools met or exceeded, whereas 2% of the students in the state-approved alternative programs met or exceeded. So questions on this? This gives you kind of an overview. It shows you where we're at with the difference between the traditional schools and the state-approved alternative programs.
There's been a side observation that even in the left-hand column, since you're doing 32% is not getting for us to crow about. But clearly a big disparity outcome between the two cohorts of students.
Correct. The second point, what are we looking at in terms of outcomes? When we look at what we would like to see or what the outcomes are for alternative programs, as do most of the alternative programs, improved attendance, students are more connected, decrease in behavioral issues, increased credit completion, and that's, by the way, from what programs are reporting is all of these are going up, especially credit completion, progress towards graduation, that the student has a post-graduation plan, at least 1 year's growth in reading and math, and meeting goals on the student's continual learning plan. According to stats, that every student has to have a continual learning plan. Is there a unique nature of different learning environments? Basically, the primary benefit for students who attend state-approved alternative programs is that the program meets the individual needs of the students they serve. A lot of programs have become project-based. The student helps design the project, very, very individualized. It's very hands-on, very much as Dr. Jennings talked about meeting the individual needs of what the student's learning style is. And this is done by a continual learning plan, which is like an individualized learning plan for every student.
Would you say that just the instance of, or the reality that these programs are trying to meet individual needs, and those needs vary from school to school across the state, that this is another large reason why there's tremendous variation from program to program, why they're all different, because they're shaped in many ways by their students that they serve. Is that accurate?
Representative Y, absolutely I would say it's accurate. You could have a student that is, you know, maybe they have the same IQ, but you've got a student that whatever happened in third and fourth grade isn't reading, so you've got a student over here that you're trying to help them with reading, and you've got another student over on the right that's excelling. And you have to make sure you're tailoring the education not only to their learning style, but their educational needs and their level. So I would agree with you. What kinds of programs are ALCs and ALPs? If I can refer back to your chart in the PowerPoint, and I'm sorry these aren't numbered, but there is a map in here. And I believe that's what you're asking for, what kinds of programs are ALCs and ALPs. And the numbers of sites. Yes. I'm sorry, I'm not numbered. It's about probably 2/3 of the way through.
I think you also touched on there are different requirements for the two different types of programs, too, the ALCs and ALPs, and ALCs, in a sense, have to offer more. They have to provide a summer programming, and whereas ALPs, is it correct to say that they do not?
Absolutely.
So if a district, say, is going to offer or have an ALC, they need to make sure that to the department that they have satisfied those areas that they provide, the summer school, the evening school.
Representative White, that's correct. And not only that, but they have to do at least middle level in high school. They can add the K-8 after-school component for at-risk students, which we call targeted services. Going to the next page, these are the additional questions that were represented, that were addressed by Representative Bly, that I want to quickly, and then we'll get to, there's one, I know you're waiting. What is the number of students who are full-time in an alternative program? Let me start and kind of call down. Let's go to the pie chart. Which again, I apologize, it's not numbered, but it's, I think it's after the math. Yeah, it's two pages after the math. Well, you might be interested in the first page after the math. This is just the numbers and what's happened to alternative, state-approved alternative programs through the years. In some years there was significant growth, but it's certainly still growing. But the one I'm most interested in looking at is the total students. The 149,000 are students that are K-12. This is K-12, so this might be students. A large chunk of it, as you look at the left-hand side of the pie chart, about 86,000 of those students are K-8 students who are accessing the alternative program after schools and summers. These are identified at-risk students who are getting additional help. They come to school a couple evenings, a couple afternoons after school, 3 or 4 weeks during the summer, but the idea is to get help them with remediation. These are students, again, that are at risk. It's a large chunk. Over to the right, grades 9 through 12, we had 63,341 students that were in grades 9 through 12. The question from Representative Greiling was, how many of these are full-time? So if you look at the description at the top of the page we're working on, according to the data from Information Technology, 17,192 students only had a record in ALC at one point during the year. And that's how we got to it at the Department of Education. So again, a little over 17,000 students had only a record in the alternative program sometime during the year where they weren't also at the traditional school. What we found was, when we were going through this today, was that what this didn't represent is that the student was coming from a traditional school, and the traditional school held them for 2 or 3 days, so it was overlap. Those numbers do not show up here. So that 17,000 is low. If you'd like us to work on getting that number and looking at the students where there might be a little bit of overlap, in other words, the school district carried them into a couple of days of when they were at the alternative program, we can get that for you.
Yes.
I'm confused enough about the 17,000.
Okay.
What I'm more interested in is the other 46,000. Are they? What are they doing?
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney. Most of the 46,000 are making up credits, but there's also a percentage in there. It's not huge, but there's a percentage that are shared time, that basically are half time in the alternative program and half time in the traditional school.
One of the reasons, if I could just address that, is that these smaller alternative programs can't offer all of the programming that a high school, comprehensive high school, can. So you will have students wanting to take an art or an auto mechanics course, and they may take only that one course, but then it causes them to go over and be counted in both places. That's one explanation, but not the only.
Actually, Chair Bly, that's a very good one. That's true. The students, by law, the students have access into the traditional school for band, choir, anything that they want to, accelerated math. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, can I?
Go ahead, Representative Abney.
Thank you. I'm trying to understand what are some of these 46,000 getting some sort of extended day experience where they're picking up credits in an after-school program, or a zero-hour before-school program, so getting much more of the sort of targeted services that you're seeing in the other half or the other part of the pie chart.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, that is correct. Most of those students are receiving services after school. They're making up credits. Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr.
Chair, all those students, one way or another, fit a criteria, the 1 to 12 criterion. The 124D.68, all right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Marin, that is correct. Every one of them has to be at risk of not graduating from high school.
Is it, so I'm just going to write this here. So is it overly simplistic to say, to deduce that there's something very different from the 17,000 plus versus the 46,000 plus? They all need to fit one of these criteria, the 124D.68, but, you know, sort of common logic tells me if there are 17,000 that are basically there all the time in this alternative setting, then that feels like a different, somehow that there's something different about that population we got in relation to the others. But I don't know,
that
just
may be dumb. No, that's a good point. A lot of students, and Representative Bly alluded to that, do not want to leave the traditional school and their friends, but they have to make up credits. One of the reasons we see that number high is sometimes we catch the students in time. A lot of times if they're not caught in time, that's when they go to an alternative program because they're so far behind in credits that they really need a whole new environment. So yes, there would be a little bit of a difference. You know, the ones that are making up credits, a lot of times we're talking 2, 3, 4 credits behind something achievable by the time they're a senior. The ones that the 17,000 plus that we're talking about that have left the system, it's because they have a different learning style. They're far behind in credits. They need that relationship building. So there would be a little bit of a difference.
And this is more for you, but that's what this all leads us to. Is there a logical reason to consider an alternative assessment system? If what we're really talking about, living by kind of garage logic here, is that the 17,000 students that feel pretty different from out of that total 149,000.
Well, if I can comment, I would say that it's misleading to break it down into a clear-cut category of 17,000 or 46,000, and it's a much more blended, actually, difference than you might think. And part of that is because there's an effort, as has been stated before, to meet the students' needs, and those needs vary greatly. And there may be parts of their life or their education experience which can be met and maintained at the high school, and others which definitely cannot. And there may be parts where they feel comfortable in the traditional setting and other parts where they do not. So it's, and I guess you could say that, well, in this particular student, maybe there's 46% that's comfortable, and there's maybe, you know, it gets difficult, I think, to really say there is this absolute difference, or there's this, it's much more, a variation, you know, a continuum, I guess.
Gradation.
Yeah. I think it's a difficult question. The one you're asking is a difficult one to answer.
No, I don't. But let me see, Mr. Chair, I mean, in terms of making the case, it's a question that's going to come up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm supposed to be skeptical of a proposal to look at anything but what we currently do to assess schools.
You could also.
I'm not supporting it. I'm just.
Yeah, you could also look at it in the opposite way and say, well, if it's not such a huge number, what's the big deal about making some allowances for these students that really need to be looked at differently? Russ and Zylan.
So the 150,000 that we saw blazoned across the newspapers that we're not keeping track of is a much smaller number. And we thought, in that same article, Kitchener, I think it was, said that we should be doing a better job, tracking them better and paying more attention how they're doing, because they want school, send them off to a school. If they encourage them to go, then they don't count in their own making KYP. What would be your response to that? What do you think? Better track of them. It just sounds like it's a smaller number. So if the paper didn't accurate? Is there anything else that might be inaccurate as far as are there things we can do better? How they're doing. I'm concerned that we don't keep track of more of the demographics than, you know, the how many are seem to, the 17,000, it doesn't sound like you really know if they're going to school full time or if they're doing independent study and show up, you know, one day a week or 1 hour a week. To me, why don't we have more data?
I think you'd be right, or you can help, you can answer this better perhaps, but I think you're right when you say we don't really know exactly of that number of the 17,000, how many are in full time, how many come one day a week, or how many come in a very limited program. We don't know. Is that accurate?
That representative Bly and Greiley, that is absolutely correct. That is something in the MARS, because all of the data that we're giving you has come through the MARS system. So any additional information you would need would have to be a directive to add that to the MARS system. For a long time we've talked about it would be very nice to know if you've got that 12 criteria, how many students are a year behind, how many students have gone through chemical dependency, mental illness, because then you could really, from a state perspective, you could see where you could allocate resources. But right now, currently, that's not in the MARS system. But it would not be a bad idea. Could they, you know, any system can be designed any way that is possible. If you wanted the numbers regarding students and how many are full-time, certainly we could put out a call to the alternative programs and ask for that data and try to pull it together. We don't have it, but we could certainly work at getting that information. Now, if I could just make one more comment back to that 17,192, it seems small because we were talking about 100 and 39,000 or whatever it was, but that's a lot of kids' lives. The 17,000 is, you know, it may seem small in relation to, but it's a lot of kids.
One other comment I wanted to make too was that since you asked Representative Mariani about should we make some kind of change in the assessments for these programs, and I think that part of the premise for asking about this is that the way that we're looking at the success of these schools right now, it's my belief, doesn't give us good information about whether or not they are being successful in their charge and what they're supposed to be doing. And if we continue to assess them in the way that we are, continue to be told that they're failing, we may lose these schools. And it's my opinion that they're doing a very good job with a set population of kids, and it would be very unfortunate to have that happen.
Just quick, I know we're trying to get in here, but that also goes to the realm of the constant the confusion. I'm part of that confusion, the speed around what our assessments are supposed to do. Because I often think about that as, I think most people in the street think of it as, well, we have a system that assesses how our kids are doing. But we also talk about an assessment system that's meant to somehow figure out how our schools are doing. And it seems like, you know, there's parts of that where how our kids are doing, how our schools are doing, aren't exactly being thought of or lined up, you know, 100%. And so the query I had to you was, you know, based on the thinking of talking about kids here. Mm-hmm. So really, what is the difference between the 17 and the 49 and 49? But you're articulating in a framework about being able to assess schools, mm-hmm. which of course has everything to do with whether or not, you know, what we do with those schools in the future, including whether we keep them.
Right. Representative Lane.
Well, as we talk about whether or not these particular, how big the number is, as to whether we would allow a different kind of assessment and perhaps value added, actually, have they made a year's progress in a year's time, regardless if they are 16 years old and they started at fourth grade reading and they moved to fifth grade reading, that's a yay. But if we're saying, is this number big enough for us to actually consider, and we have people talk about the fact that all students are different and that there's a wide span as to when it's right to learn reading and that, all these different things, and 20% are comfortable in the traditional manner, and yet we're,
it's to me, it's why are we measuring anybody at this, you know, line drawn in the sand? Not why are we not allowing 17,000 to be measured by growth. Why are we picking any line in the sand for any child?
It just
blows my mind. But I did attend something with Milwaukee schools, charters, a different sort of charter school than we have. They're part of the public schools, and the teachers develop them and run them. And basically, they're alternative programs, though they don't call them that, and they're more than just the high schools that we tend to do when we have an alternative set aside. And they have, because I talked to a board member in Milwaukee afterwards, to clarify, well, how are you measuring these so that they won't have built-in failure? Because that's what they'll do with these kind of programs. And he said they do have value added, and I don't know if it's Milwaukee or Wisconsin or what, but they do have value added as a part of their assessments for the state, and they're working very hard with the federal government to make sure that that is a part of the plan. So again, it baffles my brain that we're stuck with a line in the sand for anybody.
Two things, Mr. Chair and Representative Lane, kind of in conjunction with that, one of the projects that Marceline DeBoas, who's currently the alternative program specialist, is working on is school improvement plans for alternative programs. And we have 23 schools that went through this rigorous process of filling out school improvement plans. And what they're putting into those school improvement plans is how can they measure student growth without necessarily it being the MCA. So maybe it's the MAP, or maybe it's a decrease in referrals to the principal. It might be truancy issues. It's attendance. It is just incredible, the items and the data elements they're coming up with that they're defining, that where they're going to show that students are making progress. So I'm hoping that in another time, as we move forward, continue to move forward with this project, we can share some of that information, because alternative programs have already started that process of illustrating what they can measure to show student growth. Committee, I'd like Kathy Wagner from the Minnesota Department of Education is here. She's from Information Technology. She's the director. So I'm going to let you make
a comment. I think if you want more data on, just a pure member of the committee, if you'd like more data on alternative, students in alternative education programs, just let us know. I think we can find out whether they're independent study or not. We have some of those pieces in our enrollment system. So we could do, I guess, a more thorough study if you have specific questions. The other comment that I just wanted to add was alternative programs are included in the state accountability system. We just this past year adjusted the computation so that all students, or all schools who are paid for students, are credited with those students in the accountability system. So even if students are dual enrolled, both schools get share the credit for the student in their school's AYP rating. So that.
When did you start doing that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Growland, just this past year, we've been working to modernize our data systems and making enrollment data available in more real time so that we didn't have such a lag. So this past year, we were able to tie our accountability calculations to the enrollment calculations, which we wouldn't have been able to do in past years. Schools were their denominator for accountability, participation, and by extension then proficiency was if a student was enrolled at the school and we found a test document for them, they were credited. So if a student was enrolled at the school and we didn't find a test document, they were penalized. So that extends to students who may be enrolled in a couple of settings. The multiple settings are credited with the kids.
So then the 46,000 students that are both places are counted in the AYP for the regular school. They should be only doing well with students that they have full time. These students could take them on.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garland, they're counted in both places. So if you're serving 100 kids, you're being paid to serve 100 kids. All 100 kids are included in your scores. So whatever that mix turns out to be.
So in other words, schools can't send kids off to ALT and then avoid having the college Now, what about the 17,000 students? Are they, where are they?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garland, if the 17,000 students are uniquely full-time enrolled at an ALC, they'd be counted at the ALC for what we call participation and proficiency.
Mr. Chair, later, I'll be very interested to see if that number.
Okay.
Okay. You might give them the dates. They have to be in the program October 1. And
Mr. Chair, Representative Garland, there are some other twists about the computation. They have to be enrolled for a full academic year to be included in the academic portion. So that would be October 1 through the test window to be included in the academic results. But we would still have test results for them, and they'd be included in the participation part of the calculation for AYP if they were just in the school during the test window. So I think we can do better at getting you some specific targeted pieces of information, I think.
All right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I
can continue.
Yep, I'll finish this up quickly. Is there graduation data for alternative programs? When we started the report cards, we started the accountability in the state of Minnesota, and we had many talks about this at the Department of Education. We decided the graduation rate would go back to the school the students are resident of. The reason being is because the alternative programs can't issue a diploma. When a student comes to an alternative program, they're there to, because they're going to make up credits. That's the primary purpose of the student in education, but again, not get the diploma. So, you know, there are a couple problems with attaching a graduation rate to an alternative program. First of all, how do you determine who's a graduate? Is it a student who's been there 2 years? Is it a student who's been there for 18 credits? And how do you decide what's an ALC credit and what's ALC graduate versus a graduate from the traditional system? There was also concern, much of what you just alluded to with Representative Grayling, was that we didn't want it to become a dumping ground. In other words, students weren't doing good, so we'll just put them on the alternative program and they can deal with the lower graduation rate. So you won't ever see a graduation rate for the alternative programs that reflect, although many of the alternative programs keep track of their own graduation rate. We don't have it at the Department of Ed. It goes back to the school where they're graduating from. The Minnesota Student Survey, you have a copy of the Minnesota Student Survey. The question was asked about chemical dependency and about mental illness. I'll let you look at this if that's in your leisure. And the pages are referenced in there, pages 23 to 28 and 29 to 44. Unless you want to go through it now, or do you want to...
I'm sorry.
Do you want to go through those pages now, or should they look at them?
The
Minnesota.
Go ahead.
Okay, so if we go to page 23, and you have a copy of the Minnesota survey. Okay. 23. This is how students in state-approved alternative programs actually rated. Various questions, and it rates everything from sometimes I think that I am no good, to questions again on chemical dependency. I'm looking specifically, if you look at the top of page 24, there's another talk, you know, here's one that would, you know, could allude to mental health. You know, how has your mood been? Have you felt you were under any stress or pressure? Have you felt sad? But again, it goes through a series of questions, and you can see how the students responded to these questions. It kind of gives you an idea of how they're self-assessing their mental health and their chemical dependency. There's no question that for chemical dependency, much higher rate of chemical dependency and usage in students in an alternative program than in the general population. I can say that students are very serious about this. They don't mind answering that, and I'm sure Representative Blythe would talk to it when they do the Minnesota Student Survey in Northfield. But students, we've always taken this to be very honest. They're very honest about what their feelings are. So if you go to page 29 to 44, those are pages that will talk more about the substance abuse. Use of tobacco, you can see, extremely high. Binge drinking, alcohol usage in the past year, used both alcohol and other drugs in the past year. 50% of males and 56% of females said yes. So, and then it follows through to page, you can go to page 44, and this kind of gives you a picture of the students in the alternative programs. This study has just been completed, and the data is just being compiled. So where this study is 3 years old, the new study will probably come out in the next, I'm going to say, when it's not, it's coming out shortly. I'm going to say by the first of the year, that information will be out.
And for the people here, you didn't have enough copies to distribute to this, but you do have it on your website. People
yes.
can download the
flashcards.
Yes.
Okay.
Still struggling with this, you know, students moving from system to system. So who are these students out of those numbers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariano, these specifically are students that went. This would be one of your 17,000 students. Yeah, typically your full-time students.
Typically, however, it's possible that it could include some of the other numbers if they were in attendance at the time the survey was given.
People enroll, the students that are making up credits. But primarily, it's going to be your full-time students.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chair, we don't have we obviously don't have the comparison here, but what you're saying is that in some of these indicators, and you pointed out the mood indicators, the tobacco and drug use, you're seeing very statistically substantial differences in responses between this cohort of students and the broader community and really the public.
Any other questions for us?
Okay. We would be happy to, when the new survey comes out, we will be able to get you the information. We could compare. We could compare this year to the new information. We could compare these students to the cohort, as you referred to, in the traditional school. We would be able to get that information for you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes,
okay, well, it didn't really say, though, how many are chemically dependent or how many have diagnosed with a mental. Did it, or did I? I just looked at the question quickly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grant, I don't think that's one of the questions, because that would be self-identifying. I don't think that question's in here about are you chemically dependent.
So this is all we have to go by.
Yeah, it's right. It's their feelings about, you know, how much usage they've got. You know, do they use a lot? Do they use a little? How often? Yeah.
And I know that there are difficulties with data privacy and all of that, but would there be a way for programs, for instance, to report how many students may have been in treatment or how many that they would know of, because they wouldn't know of all of them that were getting some kind of psychiatric care. Is that possible?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. You know, and the reason I say that is because, you know, again, we go back to that key relationship piece. Most of the alternative programs know enough about the students, they would know that.
Okay. Sure. I wanted to come back to the AYP impact on programs. I'm curious about, and I know there are some students, for instance, who might be at an alternative program and might also attend an area learning center. They might be involved in both those. What would happen? Would both programs then be cited?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yeah, both programs would receive credit. wouldn't necessarily result in not making AYP.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We just felt that since we're able, if schools get paid for kids, it should be reflected mm-hmm. in whatever state accountability we have of the school. So that's
all right.
Okay, I'll finish up very quickly. What are the aggregate MCA scores for alternative ed students? We talked about those. That's a chart you have that I just referred to a while ago. Second to the last bullet, is there data that can assess whether 90% revenue flow to the ALCs is happening? There's two ways in districts do it differently. Each district, every district do it differently.
Perhaps you should give a little bit of background. I'm not sure that the other legislators understand what that means.
Okay, that's a good idea, Mr. Chair. The, in law, in statute, it says that 90% of the funding that students generate of the general ed revenue and 100% of the compensatory revenue have to follow the students. So you, one would assume, if that's the case, that if you've got, that once the money reaches the school district, they would take their 10% and then they would give the 90% to the state-approved alternative program. Unfortunately, that's not the way it doesn't quite work that easily. When that was the objective of this particular statute, that the district take 10%, and that's kind of their overhead. That's for doing the payroll. That's for providing the supervision from the superintendent's standpoint. It was for all those items that they have to do for oversight. However, I can tell you that a lot of the state-approved alternative programs, I'm sorry, a lot of the districts take their 10%, then they take some expenses out, and then they send the money to the alternative program. So by the time they take their expenses out, it might be 72%, it might be 83%. It's not uncommon that they take the 10% but take no expenses out of it and then expense from the 90. Now we don't, because of our UFARs, we don't have any way of knowing. We know what they say, you know, how many teachers and how many counselors, but we don't know, are they charging for some counselors at the traditional school because some of those counselors are helping move the students from school to the alternative program? We don't know if they're charging off some of their superintendent. We don't have the UFARs isn't able to segregate it that way. The only way you would be able to do that would be to say choose 5 or 6 programs and ask for an accounting of their UFARs. They do have a specific UFARs accounting for their state-approved alternative program.
One of the reasons for asking that question, there are several, but I guess I'm thinking about an independent study program where it may be designed to bring in revenue rather than really meet the needs of the students. You mentioned some of the concerns about some independent study programs in light of that. And I guess I'm curious if there's a way to kind of see if something like that might be happening if not. And maybe there isn't, but I was curious about that particular aspect. If it might be a way to look at what might be happening with independent study.
Representative Bly, that is correct. The only thing we would have at the department that we could look at from their UFARs is how much came in and how much they say went out. And we assume that the rest of that, other than the 10%, went into a reserve because it's also in statute that it has to go into a reserve. But we wouldn't, you'd have to again look at programs.
Okay.
And last, finally, how does MD work with alternative programs? We listed some of the elements here. Obviously provide technical assistance, data collection and analysis, which we're, as Kathy Wagner said, we're more than happy to do, continue to work with that. Collaboration with MAP, program review and approval. Every state-approved alternative program has to have go through a application process, site visits, approval, staff development. We do workshops, MD liaisons to schools, where the MD liaisons, and then development of new processes like the school improvement plan. And I'd be happy to entertain any questions, but we're very pleased that we could be here to provide this information for you. This is exciting. The alternative education in the state of Minnesota is, like I said, a fabulous choice option.
Thank you. Go ahead.
This is a question. It's just an observation. It's not meant to be negative or positive, but it's just an observation back to the demographics. 48% of students of color, that's well above the percentage that you would find on regular public schools across the state. And again, it's not a negative or a positive. It's just a pretty predominant feature of what the learning environment looks like in these schools. And I think it probably invites other times types of reflection and thinking about what's happening in those learning environments given that reality. We know that one of the requirements of the 12 is ELL, and so we would imagine that's driving some of that. But I suspect, throughout different parts of the state, there may be different issues that are driving that kind of heavy demographic representation of those communities in these schools.
I think that's a point well taken, Mr. Mariano. I think it is something to look at more carefully. One comment I wanted to make that I haven't really, and I don't think it's an intentional oversight, but one of the things that impressed me about alternative programs and my involvement with them is that there is an attempt to make sure that the student going to an alternative program felt good about that, and that they felt that they were making a choice for themselves that would be an improvement and something better. Rather than the home school saying, you must go here, or we no longer want you, but it was a program that they would like to be at rather than one that they would dread or be fearful of. Would you say that that's an accurate description?
Representative Black, absolutely. Actually, that is reflected when you look at the difference. When I've done a comparison, and I don't have one, it isn't here. When I do a comparison in the student survey, in the SO student survey, with traditional school students to alternative ed, they will talk about how they feel so much better about themselves, how much better a relationship they have with the teachers. And there are actually questions in here where you could derive that from the students, yes.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Just one other question I forgot. Back on the third page when we posed the question, what are we looking at in terms of outcomes? And there's a number 12, and there's a long list. And we talked a little bit later about the growth measurements. Is that more than a rhetorical question? Is the department actually using a framework where there's expected reporting on all these indicators, from attendance, progress toward graduation? I mean, some of these sound similar to what you would be doing with any other school, but what is the formal process that's happening? I mean, about an hour, we've spent a lot of time, but is there a sort of formal kind of dynamic that's happening at the department in terms of de facto coming up with a different way to understand and assess what's happening in these schools?
Mr. Chair, Representative Marino, that is, yes. And when I returned and talked about the school improvement plan, in the school improvement plan that the schools developed, many of these items are in there, including the growth, the way they're using it, the MAP, the NWA, which is a very common test, where they're showing growth. But yes, most of these, not every one of these is covered in every school improvement plan, but a lot of them are. A lot of them are looking at credit completion. They know how many credits are completed last year. They want a 20% increase in the number of credits that are going to be completed next year. Or behavioral issues. They know how many behavioral issues. So again, they're looking for what they can do to decrease that and come up with a different number. So yes, this is real stuff that's happening in alternative programs.
One last question. Do all kids have to meet the criteria to go to the alternative schools? Because if 20% of the kids are all that's comfortable in the regular school, and any group I've ever talked to from ALCs are thrilled to be there. The kids like it, and they say the teachers care, and they have a lot of positives to say. Are there students who would like to go who can't? Or is it just the ones who qualify that end up there that learn about them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Graham, students have to meet one of the 12 criteria. And if they don't meet one of the criteria in 124D.68, they cannot go to an alternative program.
Right, so I know that, but I'm just asking then, Mr. Chair, are there students who don't meet the criteria who wish they could be there because they're in the 80% that don't like traditional school?
Yes, that's correct.
Thanks. Well, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
I'd like to hear from a panel of three directors. Why don't you all come up and then you can.
Thank you.
Is this a you, God? Why don't we start with you, Mr. Allen, and you can introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Steve Allen, Representative Bly. Thank you for having me, committee members. Thanks for allowing me the opportunity. If I could detour just a little bit off on my presentation for a couple of side notes of the previous conversation. I hope that by no means there's implied a negative connotation towards independent study. And I would welcome any of you to come and visit our program at any time. And that's an open invitation. We feel pretty pleased with what we're doing. The second thing is the editorial comment with the editorial board. You need to know, Representative Grayling, that MAP did attempt to go. We met with the editorial board at the Star and Tribune and challenged their writings, and we didn't get anywhere, but we did go and meet with them. So that was the other comment.
We share something in common. We have that experience.
And the other comment that I want to make, and that's on trying to get your handle around these numbers. I am one of the old guard in alternative ed. I was the first president of the Minnesota Association of Alternative Programs, and I'm currently president-elect to take on another term. Something's wrong. And 25 years ago, when our organization started, it was not uncommon for every three students that we had, it took three students to generate one ADM, or one full-time equivalent. One of the things I'm really proud about, and I don't think that Ms. Kibble alluded to it enough, is she knows it too, and is very good about supporting it, the amount of collaboration that we do with our regular school partners has increased, and also with other agencies, and the brokering and sharing of students back and forth makes the complexity of the record keeping really hard to get your hands around. Right now it takes about 6 to 1 for every one of 6 of my students that I'm processing, it takes to generate one ADM. But that's good for the student, because we're really trying to customize the educational needs of the student. And I think that says a lot about our regular ed partners that we have. I would like to continue by saying that I am the director of the Oakland Cooperative Center and president-elect of Minnesota Association of Alternative Programs. Oakland is a cooperative of 3 school districts, Cambridge-Isani, Princeton, and St. Francis. Our cooperative has been around for over 30 years. We provide a wide variety of programs for at-risk students. That's the difference between an alternative program and an area learning center. An area learning center is supposed to be, as Gloria and Ms. Kibble alluded to, a comprehensive service delivery agent. And that I'm really proud about with Oakland is we do have a variety of programming. The use of traditional academic standardized assessments, such as the Minnesota Basic Skills Test or the MCATs, is one way to assess students. I don't think it is a very good way to assess all students. I do not feel it is a very good instrument to be used for holding programs accountable. The late Paul Wellstone used to say that you shouldn't use standardized assessments to hold schools accountable for things out of their control, such as the social economic ills of our society. The current assessment process is also flawed because it is an end-of-the-line assessment. After 12 years, if the student doesn't have the competencies, the student doesn't graduate, and the school, at the end of the line, at the end of the process, gets the blame. So if that student spends 11 and a half years in the regular ed system, who gets cited on AYP at the end when the kid transfers the Area Learning Center, the alternative program? I don't agree with that. Same way I don't agree with the statement that was made that we all get, the comment was made that the ALCs are all being credited when they're both counts, when they're dual enrolled, and the ALC has the kid for one credit at night school. I'm making up a math credit or an English credit or a social studies credit. And he's in the K-12 system for 12 years. And we both get cited? That's equity? I don't think so. And I think that needs to be real clear. The current assessment process, as I said, it doesn't seem right. It seems like the hot potato analogy, you know, whoever gets stuck holding the potato at the end. And we don't turn kids away just because they failed. We welcome them in. And some people say, don't take them before the such and such date. No, we don't do that. You know, they get credited our account, we take them. Okay? The alternatives are not afraid, as Terry Lydell alluded to, of accountability. What we are afraid of accountability systems that's not accurate in projecting the blame or the responsibility. The current assessment process is also based, as Terry said, on lagging indicators that are often irrelevant to our students in an alternative program. Lagging or delayed indicators are like fixing a flat tire after it goes flat. Modern cars have sensors in the tires that tell you when the tires begin to lose air. This is an example of a leading indicator. Leading indicators give educators the ability to predict and solve problems before it is too late. The critic may say, we do not have these predictors. We do have these predictors. They are the standardized assessments that are given to students in the lower grade levels. But what do they predict? Who can read, write, and do math? They don't reflect upon the root causes of why the other students can't read, write, or do math. These are the real root causes that are that we are failing to identify in the current assessment process. If we can identify root causes of why students aren't making adequate progress, we can close the learning gap for all subgroups. It appears that the social-emotional needs of at-risk students are getting more complex and interfering with learning. Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs states how human needs affect learning. When I originally wrote this, I wrote, everybody knows this, and my secretary proofed it. I don't know it. So I told her I would mention that she didn't know it. I'm sure I'm going to hear it. If we fail to address the students' lower level needs, there's no way that we will meet their higher level or cognitive needs. More recent research has been completed in the Ed Vision's HOPE study. In the purpose statements of the study, the author wrote, evaluating schools is solely in terms of standardized test scores oftentimes does not reveal the true nature of the learning environment and how the environment contributes to the student's long-term success. The very nature of our students' behavior prevents many of our students from making adequate progress. We need to address the root causes. These behaviors in order to improve academic skills. Some of the root causes are teen pregnancy, chemical dependency, behavior disorders, poverty, social-emotional disorders, lack of support system, and the dysfunctional and transient nature, as you heard, some of the students moving from program to program and school to school. Plus, much of the failure that an at-risk student faces is also due to the overemphasis of high-stakes testing and the depersonalization of the educational process. I would like to recommend that we utilize the alternative programs as entrepreneurs for change and reform. I heard a wonderful presentation last week by the superintendent of Owatonna saying that we've got everything set up for us to do this. We just have to be empowered. Encourage alternative programs to develop assessments that are truly reflective of student performance over a period of time. I have no problem. You tell me Johnny comes into my program in the beginning of his senior year and he leaves at the end of the senior year, I should be accountable for that. I have no problem with that. We do NWA MAP testing to do that type of assessment. One of our alternative schools, St. Cloud Area Learning Center, had one of the best MAP NWA assessment programs last year, and you can go talk to Mark Lindquist, the director up there. Mark Lindquist showed true academic growth of his students, and his students worked their tails off to improve their academics, and he customized the classrooms based around the needs of the kids and their performances on the NWEA test. He had significant growth. The kids did not take the MCAs as seriously. They got cited for lack of participation. even though they had all this other data, they had another multiple measurement. You know, that's pretty good data to me. Encourage alternative programs to utilize adaptive assessments that provide quicker and more relevant instructional information. I know the feds won't allow all this, but sometimes we got to take on Big Brother. Encouraging alternative programs to develop assessments that can be utilized as leading indicators, indicators that predict what systemic change is necessary. For example, a colleague sent the following quote from a website for the Greater Houston Community Foundation, and it reads, NASA statistics prove that most teens relapse 80%, but the rate of relapse is much lower for those able to attend a recovery school environment, 30%. When adolescents return to school after treatment, they face tremendous challenge, academic challenges, as well as emotional stress, as they are surrounded once again by peers who continue to use drugs and alcohol. Succeeding academically can help students stay sober, which in turn can encourage them to graduate. Poor academic performance is the single strongest predictor of dropping out. The people and people who drop out of school have a higher rate risk of relapsing than those who finish school. Do you think we could identify a leading indicator or root cause of academic failure from the statement above? I would like to close by saying that our students can and will learn. We sometimes need to go through what an old colleague counselor of ours called a transformation process. He even created a transformation rubric that showed when the kids were changing, and it takes time. It takes time, and it generally has nothing to do with reading and math. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you, Ms. Carroll. Any questions for us? I just wanted to make a comment that my earlier comments about independent study, I know your program, it's an excellent program, and what I was hoping to imply was that there are some programs that are starved, and they don't do well because of the lack of funds, and it is an excellent model for some students, and we really need to make sure that it works. Ms. Gillick, would you like to go next and introduce yourself for the record?
Okay. I'm Julia Gillick, director at the White Bear Lake Area Learning Center. And Steve, take a breath. You can see Steve and I have worked together for many years, and he's passionate about this. And you know what? When he talks, we listen, because he certainly does get it. And I think you can see his passion. Hope I'm not going to dry things down a little bit. But I decided to take a little track here where I would go ahead and introduce you to four students. And I'm not going to name them by name. And I just thought you've got a lot of data here, and maybe this will just reinforce the data that you have. And I am going to put my little reading glasses on and read a little bit here. White Bear Lake does have a strong history and tradition of serving non-traditional students. And we've done that through, well, it's on record since 1975, but we certainly were doing it before that. But we've had specialized individual classrooms. We've had content classrooms for students who struggle in math, reading, study skills, school-within-school settings. We've had learning communities with advisors, homeroom-type settings with tutoring. We've had case management of selected students. We've had after-school programming, evening programming, independent study, small area learning center and a portion of a reopened elementary school, and then our current area learning center, which occupies the entire small school. Our current enrollment is 156 students. This number typically will increase to 180 by the end of the first semester. That's in January. By the end of the school year, we will enroll almost twice that number of students. What I mean by this is that our students are mobile, and we get our students from feeder districts. And right now, 8 to 10 districts feed our district, our alternative program. So approximately 59% of our students enroll after October 1st. 59% of them. Currently, we have 30% students of color. Our free and reduced number are 51%. and that's compared with our district compiled number, it's 21%. Typically, our gender ratio is 40 to 45% female, 55 to 60% male. However, our seniors really even out at 50-50 in terms of gender. 14% of our students receive special education services. Last year, our seniors numbered 101, and we graduated 77. So 77% graduation rate. So I think what I'm doing by these sharing these statistics with you is showing that we do know our students, and we can easily hand you statistics if you want that by program. You're passing notes. I have to recognize that. Anyway, we're a small school and we're proud of it. Our students do choose to be there. They are referred, but we work on a system where we invite parents in, they get to visit our school, see what we're about, and then they choose whether they want to continue with that referral or not. I mentioned that I selected 4 students that I just wanted you to meet. We have a teen parent program on site with daycare. Our teen parents are primarily female and actively parenting their young. Each year we have 20 to 25 female students who are involved with our program. That's each year. The teen parents that come to mind, this particular one is just turned 17 and she has an 18-month-old daughter. She lives with her parents. She lived with them during the pregnancy, but then moved in with the child's father when her child was 2 months old. Her boyfriend had a full-time job and was attending an alternative program in St. Paul. And so at that particular time, she did not qualify for MFIP. That's the state support system. He lost his job, then she moved back with her parents. She had a part-time job. In the meantime, she had prolonged headaches, went to the hospital, and she's suffering from swelling in the brain and then consequently suffered a stroke. So her medical issues are huge, her personal issues. She is getting tremendous support from her boyfriend and parents. We helped her with a lot of the paperwork. We're helping her with a lot of the transitions. We're very much involved with her as she's at the hospital recovering from the stroke. She will not graduate with her class. Her basic skills in math are below the required basic skills scores. She will graduate, but she won't graduate on time. She will need more time to complete. And that's an answer to some of your questions. But it's there for her. I have another student with mental health issues. We're working with a young lady who had a mental health crisis last summer and became suicidal. She's connected with psychiatric services. Another student came with us struggling with peer relationships. As we got to know her, we diagnosed that there were more serious problems, connected her with services, worked with her family. This student's been in and out of residential care throughout her 11th and 12th grade year now with us, and we've worked with therapists, social workers for appropriate care and support. Her family wanted her in school through pretty much all this, or her time in between. But her education became less of a priority as her mental health needs became primary. She will graduate, but not with her class. She will graduate, but her coping skills, mental health, and emotional needs are more of a concern now than her academic needs. She will graduate, but not on time. She needs more time to complete. She needs more transitional skills. We have a school-within-school recovery school, and we've had this now for 6 years, and this program serves 18 to 22 students each year. And these are the students that we've talked about that need the direct support to remain sober. They've had 30 days of sobriety, and they really need this intense process to be successful in school. Most of our students that come to this particular program have a dual diagnosis, and what we mean by that is not only are they chemically dependent, but they also have mental health issues. So we work closely with the mental health agencies and chemical dependency treatment. We work closely with Dakota County, Ramsey County, Washington County, because of our location.
I feel like I'm sorry to interrupt you. We are running.
Yes, I knew you were going to cut me off.
Okay. I'm sorry to do that.
You
have others that would step. And I'm getting, you're wondering about my path being passed now, so I'm getting those from Leslie out there.
Okay.
I'll just talk to that.
Now, you guys, you know that I'm talking specifically about the students that are located at our Area Learning Center, and we have school-within-school programs at the other high schools and middle schools. So, but I'm just pointing these out because we have direct contact. Okay. Bottom line is all of these students will graduate with these extended services. With those students in mind, we, the teachers, know these students. We know that they succeed with compassion, competency, and connection. We know that they succeed with rigor, relevance, and relationship. We do the MAP testing, which is the NWA, so we're able to track their progress. And I just wanted to let you know that I went ahead and attached these to my report because I felt that this explained succinctly in terms of what maybe some outcome measurements should be. Broad outcomes in terms of academic, vocational, social, emotional, physical. Climate, we talked about the school climate, feeling safe. Instruction and curriculum. Youth engagement, because again, we are trying to get these students reconnected. They're somewhat disenchanted and disenfranchised. And then making connections to services and resources. And then the other document that I attached is from the Colorado Trust. And again, it's about positive youth development. It's not just something that ALC's conjured up and said, isn't that nice? This is sound research, and I want you to see this, that it's all of us, the high schools, the community, Area Learning Center is part of that. And that's my statement.
Thank you. And I hope you can get a sense of why we asked these three folks to come, and see if you will ask you to go next.
Thank you. I'd like to thank you all for allowing me to visit with you. I am proud to represent the City Incorporated. It is, among other things, an alternative high school. In fact, the oldest in Minneapolis. We celebrate this year our 40th anniversary. We operate in near North Minneapolis and in Phillips and Powderhorn. And for the last few years, we've also had an area learning center for younger kids, the goal for which is that we do not see them in our alternative high school. In the last 6 years I've been at the City Inc., we have graduated over 300 kids, and we have buried seven. Indeed, the only thing higher than the murder rate in North Minneapolis is the teen pregnancy rate. You need to understand this, I think, about contract alternatives. We are not the high wire. We are the safety net. We are not the assembly line. We are the collision shop. I speak for myself. And I don't mean lubing and oil changes and brake pads. I'm talking about rebuilding engines and transmissions, straightening frames. The difficulty that I have with testing is that there is too much of it. The state mandates testing, the district mandates testing, and surprise of surprises, our teachers have tests as well. It is a high tension activity for our students, and our students come to us with little confidence in their abilities. They have been told for years, many of them, that they are different, that they are dumb, that they cannot achieve. And so we find ourselves building their confidence, building them up to the point that they can be wrong about something without it corroborating what they have been told for years. The other thing I have about against testing is that it is a photograph. It's not a motion picture. You can test me, you can weigh me today, you can photograph me today, and you will gather data about my size and weight, but you will not be able to tell, to understand how much weight I've gained since I quit smoking in April. That's not going to be a part of what you gather. Testing is to education, in my view, what rote learning is to students. It asks no analysis or comprehension. It breeds no wonder, no appreciation, no awe, and certainly no love of learning. It encourages folks, like us, to wave sheaves of data and render flawed conclusions unassailable. I have said we rebuild engines and transmissions. We also hammer out the largest dents. Our students come to us, many of them homeless, and those many who are not are what we call couch hoppers, who don't have stable, same address week in, week out, month in, month out. We hammer out the largest deaths, but what we do not do is we do not buff and sand and prime and paint, because we respect and accept and love the kids the way they look when they get there. And we will continue to do that as long as we can. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions for thank you very much that you've given us good information about your programs and the tremendous work that you're doing.
Thanks
so much. I'm sorry I had to cut you off.
No, that's okay. Thank you for taking our concerns. It's very impressive that you've taken this on.
It is indeed.
So, Mr. Chair, if I can just...
Yes.
I did want to make a very quick comment on you know, some common themes here, and I was struck by the toolkit. I've seen that toolkit before, but this is the Colorado Trust. And all of those are very important dynamics, but I was particularly struck by the cultural competency piece of this. And so I'm kind of a one-note Johnny, but you know, I'm circling back to that 48%. You know, I think that there are some strong racial cultural competency issues that increasingly we're called upon to become competent in because of the increasingly diversifying nature of our student population. And that seems to be multiplied in this type of learning arena. I mean, I think that's a challenge for all our schools. But it seems to me, I mean, that's what that big number tells me. And so when I was thinking about Fred's students, that I nodded because I know who those students are, and I know that part of it is that they are kids of color who really don't see themselves fitting in a system that has no appreciation for the fact that they are African American or Indian or et cetera. But I just want to express appreciation for being about that and being about that not in an ideological way, but just in a very practical, you know, this is what it takes to get the job done way.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chair, I've got over 300 students up the street at a scholarship thing that my other organization is doing right now with the Gates Millennium Foundation and with the Page Foundation, so I feel real need to get over there and see a few words. So I'm going to scoot out, I don't want that to be, you know, for the audience to think that means I don't care about this agenda at all.
We did get started late, and you know, I apologize for that. We do have one more testifier, Cheryl Lang, and I would like her to share information with us if she can.
Well, she's coming. I was just wondering if I could emphasize something I believe Julia said. Did you say that 51% are free and reduced lunch, whereas the districts you serve are 21% free and reduced lunch? Yeah, that's a start. That's showing who is appearing at these schools, at least in this area.
Did you introduce yourself?
Mr. Chair, can you...
committee members, my name is Cheryl Lang, and it is spelled L-A-N-G-E. It
is
misspelled on the agenda. I'd like to give you a little background about myself, so you can put into context some of the information that I'm going to give you. I have conducted research on alternative schools and programs for now over 15 years. First, in my role as a researcher at the University of Minnesota, where I was a principal investigator on federally funded projects where research was conducted in the mid-1990s, specifically on alternative schools and programs in Minnesota with matching comparison groups in traditional high schools. Some of that information was presented in referee journals and is available online at the University of Minnesota. Secondly, I started my own research and evaluation firm in the late 1990s, and through that organization, I have been a part of doing research both at the University of Minnesota, where I continued as a subcontractor, and also nationally in Ohio and Michigan most recently. And the work at the University of Minnesota was done across the United States. And so we have a database that looks at alternative programs across the United States to get an idea of how the definition varies from state to state. That is a bit of context. What are some of the studies and what have they found? I'm going to give you just a brief synopsis of those. First of all, the Enrollment Options Project that was conducted in the 1990s here in Minnesota. We found that it was essential to use multiple measures to understand the programs and their impact on student outcomes. Without multiple measures, the end result of the study would have been a very one-dimensional view of the programs and whether or not they're succeeding. Second, we use multiple measures to inform more than progress, but also the underlying reasons that students attend these programs and how those reasons may impact other behaviors other than just academics. We use the National Center on Educational Outcomes at the University of Minnesota, their research as a framework which has about 7 different outcome areas. Those include areas such as academics, personal and social development, responsibility behaviors, post-secondary outcomes, and so on. Second area I'd like to emphasize is a research review that we did for the United States Department of Education through a project called Project Form. It was specifically done by Sandra Sletten and myself through our company to look specifically at alternative education and the research that has been done over the years. It was a literature review. It is available online at nasdsc.org. From this study, what we found is there are very few seminal studies across the country that really provide information that can be used to understand alternative schools and programs. We also found that it is one of the fastest growing educational settings in the country. That being said, it was a little bit scary to take a look at it and realize that there was not a lot in the literature, other than some of the stuff we did in Minnesota, some work that was done in Michigan earlier, that really could be considered salient and respected studies in this area. We found from this alternative review, and one of our recommendations actually to the United States Department of Education was that they had to take a look at alternative programs across the country and understand what the definition of them. So after completing that review, we also became part of the Alternative School Project here at the University of Minnesota. That project, the principal investigator is Dr. Cammie Lear. And through that program, we wanted to take a look at alternative programs across the United States because we wanted to understand the topology, is what we called it, of programs. How does Minnesota's program, for example, differ than Mississippi's or differs from Pennsylvania's? We were looking at it through the lens of special education, but as I've done with all of my research, even though it may be funded through the Office of Special Education, it's very important to have a contextual framework, and that was all kids who attend alternative programs. So we received and had findings that are very applicable here in Minnesota and all parts of the country. One of the findings that I think is relevant to this discussion is that in surveying both special ed directors and alternative school directors at the state level and doing site visits across the country, we found that the states by and large haven't had accountability systems that really measure both the success of the programs or the demographics and some of the issues that you've been grappling with this evening. Minnesota has recently begun to gather some of this information and disaggregate it by these programs, and that is a really big step forward. But they, in the past, as in other states, this was not disaggregated by these schools or these programs. And what we found at the end was that through the lack of data collection, you were actually getting programs that were flying under the accountability radar. So that there's a whole group of students for whom very little is known as to whether or not their programming is successful. The second thing we found that I think is important for you to put into context is that in Minnesota, our programs are by and large schools of choice, alternative programs. Alternative programs across the country, when you see it and you read the literature, you'll find that they are sitting in a continuum from placement programs where, believe it or not, some kids are placed because they have safety pants. That does happen in other parts of the country, and they're placed there sometimes for an entire year because of those safety pants. To schools of choice, which is where Minnesota is, and that Minnesota is oftentimes thought as an exemplary model for alternative schools and programs and how other states should be reviewing and viewing this educational setting. The data from that study, the Alternative School Project, can also be found at the University of Minnesota's ICI website. And we have a lot of information that we gathered through that would be pertinent to your discussions. The third thing that I want to highlight is that in 2005-2006, we were in the state of Ohio and were hired by an educational management organization to take a look at over 20,000 students that were attending schools that have similar characteristics to Minnesota's alternative school programs. One of the things we were charged to do was to determine an accountability system as we viewed those 20,000 kids. We did develop that, and secondly, what we found was cause for concern. Because the current model that was found in this state, in this case of Ohio, did not provide the kind of information that could help policymakers or practitioners really improve their services and take a look at continuous improvement for students. That is a private study, but it has been used in that in the context of that state, and I can say that it has informed some of our work since that time. Since that time, we have continued working with other states around accountability. We're in over 20 states where we do work either, well, most generally in accountability, or also in the area of special education and in mathematical modeling around social service issues. But most recently, we've been in the state of Michigan, and we used the Ohio information to inform a study that we did for that group of schools in that state. Again, these were high schools that served predominantly students, well, not predominantly, all students that have the at-risk characteristics that you've been discussing here. What we found through the review of the literature that we conducted for that study, so that means we reviewed the literature not up just to 2002, when our first review was conducted, but also literature from 2002 to 2007, is that, again, there's very few studies that really take a look at what is happening in the alternative school educational arena. I hypothesize that one of the reasons for that, and this is just a hypothesis, is that due to the emphasis on No Child Left Behind, due to the emphasis on specifically reading and mathematics over these years, I think there's been very few funds left over to take a look at some of these other issues that we address and need to address in education. This is one of them. If you have as many kids as we have that are currently either have dropped out, we do, and these are their salvation programs oftentimes, we have to take a look at them seriously. So, what else did we find? We found that through a review of the literature, most common statistic we found is that 30% of our high school students are considered dropouts. That was found again and again in the literature. We know there's controversy around those rates, but nonetheless, even if it is less than that, it's too high. Secondly, we found in our review that schools specifically serving this population are untraditional in their approach. Many of them may start at noon, may go to 8 o'clock at night. They may, most of the time, the ones that we have taken a look at are year-round. They may be computerized totally. You can go on and on with characteristics that don't necessarily fit our view of traditional, especially high school education. The role of accountability for these students, We also found that some of the previous studies indicated that high stakes can lead to program or student decisions that aren't in the best interest of graduation. I think that that's been in some ways already addressed in some of the previous testimony, but I think that the bottom line is that in one of the schools, I'll give an example, if test day is March 17th, I can tell you where those kids are, and they're not in school to be tested that day. They might be there on the 15th, and they might be there on the 17th. But when they know that this is something for which they are going to likely fail because it is at a high stakes level versus at a level from which they entered the program, they often just give up. And sometimes that means they may be there on the 15th, they're not there on the 16th for testing, and they don't come back. And so how we use testing is critically important. We don't want accountability systems to actually be a negative. I mean, that's just a ridiculous idea and a ridiculous way to approach it. Secondly, there are several studies of which I have a report that is I'm waiting for release from the folks in Michigan. When I do, I will send it on to you. And I won't go through the list of all the various references here, but one of the things all of these studies agree on is that accountability systems in their current, the way they currently are designed, are not salient to the issues for this population. And I want to just, I know that it's getting late, but I do want to talk a little bit about that. So, why is that the case? Number one, there's high rates of turnover. In some of the schools and states we've been in these programs where we've actually looked at the data in detail, we find that 50% of the students are often turning over. Okay, and sometimes, in some of the, when you get, and when you actually do implement a good accountability system, you start to get at the roots of things that need to be looked at. For example, in a recent study, when we took a look at, when we reviewed the number of students in that school who had been tested on their high-stakes testing, we found perhaps 40 kids. Over the course of a year, that school had enrolled over 400 students. But it just so happened that on the day of testing, only 40 students were in attendance because of turnover and other issues. So what is that going to tell you? Not a whole lot. So if you rely on that measure alone, you're not going to really learn anything. It's irrelevant. And that isn't fair to those students. We need to have a system that's fair to them, where we hold, as the folks have said, high levels of accountability, yes, but accountability that makes sense. So I'm going to jump to what we have found through our work. There's all kinds of work that I wanted to comment on that has been done through the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. There are several resources and several references in that regard. But I want to talk to you about how I believe a good accountability system should be designed for these students particularly, but also perhaps for more than just these students. But in this case, our conversation is around students who attend non-traditional programs, which I would call alternative schools and programs. Number one, the accountability system has to align with the mission. Someone on the panel here asked earlier, you know, what's the purpose? Well, that's exactly the relevant and the most important question. What data we gather should be aligned with the mission of the program. In the case of Minnesota's HSCI students, this is for assisting students for whom the non-traditional program has perhaps not been successful, but for whom have other factors, risk factors, that affect education. So we need to have an accountability system that takes those things into account. The traditional system may not be that. So we need to take a look at what actually aligns with the mission. Secondly, let me go back to that. There are two approaches. Robert Lynn is a very well-known, I call him the guru in assessment. He talks about two approaches to testing. One is the current status model, which is what we use here in Minnesota. What's the current status of the kids? Okay? And I kind of just are always looking at the current status. As one of the folks before me commented on, it is a photograph. The other is the growth model, which, of course, we've all talked about. But it is critical with these kids. The data that we have gathered over years of work across states, we find that the students oftentimes are entering the programs not at not at grade level, but many grade levels behind. So if we give them a test, one test, and it is at a reading level is up here, it isn't going to tell us whether or not they've gone from a fourth grade level to a seventh grade level, or in the case of one of the things that I suggested, at least we get them to a point of literacy, which in work we do, we usually define as eighth grade. So let's find out where they really are. So Lynn recommends a growth model across all accountability systems, by the way. So first thing, align with the mission and make sure that your assessments also are aligned with that mission in terms of who you're using. Secondly, the need for multiple measures. Literature suggests that many areas should be included in assessing student success, especially for this population, and they were commented on by many. It was very heartening to hear the different indicators that have come up over this evening, because they also are those that emerge from the research. One of the major shortcomings of the current system that's found in here and the work that we've done is that, in fact, when we stick to one measure, we aren't understanding the broad and multiple dimensions of the programs for whom you're funding. If you're funding them for a specific reason, let's find out then if they are actually meeting and successful in the areas that you're providing the funding. So the BEST system bases accountability, this is on combination of student outcomes, prior achievement and background, and school and organizational processes. Again, several studies support the use of multiple measures, and in the work that we've done, there are lists, and there's all kinds of crosswalking that we've done, and they pretty much end up with many of the similar things, similar areas when you are looking at kids with who are at risk for school non-completion. The third thing, aside from using multiple measures, and I want to stress that multiple measures means more than just academic measures. It means taking a look at attendance, taking a look at retention, taking a look at their personal and social adjustment, taking a look at chemical dependency and some of the issues that might relate to that. The list is broader than just a specific academic. The third step in designing a new accountability approach for these programs, address relevant student characteristics. Ms. Kibble talked about how complicated it is to understand the alternative programs in schools in Minnesota. This goes across the country. But we can design an accountability program that does take that into account. I know that the department can do it. It just needs kind of the go-ahead for that to be the case. They have the wherewithal to do it, and we have the wherewithal within the state. The plan and accountability is only as good as data gathered and analysis conducted. If you go back to one or two indicators of success and you analyze them in a very narrow way, you will not understand these programs and you will not know if your money is well spent. And in the end, we won't know whether or not we serve the children or not. So what are some of the areas? Age range, education status, incarceration status, parenting status, grade level upon entry, risk factors experienced prior to entry, credit history, and current achievement level are some of the data that should be collected through the course of a student attending these schools and then disaggregated as you analyze the data. Because you need to understand whether or not the program is working for one group of students that has certain characteristics versus another. Because the bottom line is we want these programs to get better, and we want the students to succeed. The last piece, and I think is equally as important, and perhaps is an area that I have great passion for, is that an accountability system has to be designed using a temporal approach. What do I mean by a temporal approach? Exactly what I alluded to earlier, that if you have 40 kids out of 400 taking a test on March 16th, you aren't getting an idea of what's happening to the other 360. You need to design an accountability plan that looks at data over slices over the course of a year, and I mean an entire calendar year, because many of these schools are 12-month schools. We need to understand what's happening at these slices and then provide the information back to the practitioner, to those of you that make policy decisions, so that we have a good foundation for understanding what's happening with kids. That has to have multiple measures that go across various dimensions of both the school's program and the students themselves. Alan Olson, in response to NCLB, he is the, I don't know if he's the CEO, but I know he's one of the founders of NWEA that's been referred to this evening. had this quote recently in Education Leadership. He gave a critique of the current accountability system. Well-intentioned though NCLB may be, certain aspects of the law actually deter schools from fostering academic growth for some students. Can't design a system like that, and that's the current system. It isn't just here, it's across the country. But I do believe we have an opportunity to inform not just what's happening here in Minnesota, but what's happening in states that have alternative schools and programs. So the data supports that you have to take a look at high mobility, low retention, low intake of achievement levels. You have to understand that the kids are coming from various schools. As someone said earlier, the accountability system has to have that built in. We are at an age where we can do that technologically. It can happen. So what are the questions you need to consider? And what do people that are looking at these programs, do you know what the retention rates are in these schools? And do you know why they may be what they are? Do you know how well the students are demonstrating growth upon entry? They're designed for at-risk youth. Do you know if the programs are reducing the at-risk behaviors for which they're designed? Can you tell if there's a particular group for which this program is more successful? We learned some of that in our study in the 1990s that said that here in Minnesota, that there did seem to be a profile of a child for whom the alternative programs were most successful. You can design and take material that may help design individual programs for these kids. Are the programs retaining their students? Are they transitioning to the next program, whatever that may be, and having success? And then how do these other outcomes, be they achievement outcomes, be they the responsibility, social development, those larger pieces, how do they affect that success? The bottom line is that you need to look at the mission of the schools, align the accountability plan and process accordingly using the four components I mentioned, gather data that will result in improvement for students and for the program. The current system is not doing that, and we owe these kids a lot more. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm wondering if there's a possibility if you could come back at another time to give us a little more in-depth background on what you which the others can hear as well.
Yeah. Okay. I would be happy to do that.
Okay. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you. Ms. Lang, I don't know if you've seen the position paper here of MAP on determining adequate yearly progress with multiple measures of accountability.
I have not, no.
Okay. I don't know that you need to have, except to know that it's an exhaustive list, and frankly, an exhausting list of possible dimensions on which to evaluate programs. And even you were kind of going into a number of possible measures. And if you could just respond even briefly, and I'm struggling with two pieces. Are we evaluating the students or are we evaluating the programs? Is one struggle. And how many different variables can we really handle and end up with a final product that the average person is going to be able to understand and use?
That's a great question, and I have boiled them down to what I believe are the most important indicators. And so,
how many is that?
Well, I don't think it matters how many, because, for example, there may be several under demographics, mm-hmm. but I hate to say that that's 10. I mean, demographic data is gathered, and that's not anything new. There might be a couple of new pieces, which are transfer credits, when a student comes in to understand exactly how many credits they have entering, you know, some things of those nature. But other pieces of data that we suggest is certainly an intake or a screening around academic achievement that with periodic testing that would look at growth. I really do have some question as to whether or not the current state mandated tests have any value at all. And so I think that one of the things we have to look at is whether they do until a student has a certain level of proficiency in reading and mathematics. So that may be totally politically incorrect, but I'm going to put it out there. In other areas, obviously, graduation status, not necessarily graduation from these programs in Minnesota, but do they graduate ever? And then there are some things we can do and design software programs that can take a look at how much time of credits they accrued in the various settings that they've had. Reasons for withdrawal status, retention data. Retention is huge. I think we have to look at it much more seriously than we are. Then baseline survey of independent living skills, surveys of work skills. There's some data that supports that through scans. I don't know if you're familiar with the old stuff that came out of the 1980s from the federal government looking at work skills. The acronym is escaping me. But that we do need in these programs to determine whether or not these kids are ready. And that this doesn't have to be, as Ms. East said, testing. There are ways we can do and gather this information that can be embedded into the program. Also, taking a look at at-risk and health behaviors. We just gathered some information in Michigan on this from students and all of those kinds of things. So I don't think you have to go broad, but I think what's more important is when. If you only do it once a year, I mean, I think you may as well just not do it. So you have to take into account the mobility and transient nature of these kids. And the programs, I would say, cry out for information that is relevant to what's happening. And that is going to be on student populations at certain times. In answer to your first question about who are you holding accountable, the accountability model that we use in all of our work is a multi-accountability approach. It includes, yes, there's students. Student outcome data is actually an indicator of whether or not the rest of us are doing our job. Okay? And we follow there are a few others that have this approach. Again, Robert Lynn is one of them, that all of us are accountable. That includes students, the teachers, the families, the leadership, the boards, and our communities. And that there are ways that we can actually gather information on that. And I've been doing it across the country. I just returned from Hawaii where I was helping some schools there design programs that had a multi-phase approach.
I'd even add legislators to that list.
Well, I would, but yes. In fact, I think if the program shows success and if funding is a major issue or policy direction, yes, I do think it comes back right here.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity.
Yes. Any other comments or questions, concerns?
Thank you.
Okay. Anything that you feel you didn't get an answer to that you'd like to get further information on?
Make a comment. I think that one of the things that we are not looking at, and it's a personal focus of mine, is where are these children when they are in the womb and 1, 2, or 3? Because that is when the foundation for the academic learning starts. And it actually does have some sensitive periods and some points at which that development is pretty well done, not necessarily by 3, but within by the age of 7, many of those levels of the brain development are done. Not finished and complete forever, but basically done. And if the situation in a society sense, I don't think education department has any relevancy to this area at all, but if we as a society don't look at some of the situations that these children are coming out of, that's why I emphasize whether that White Bear Lake one, a lot of the kids are coming out of much more, 51% out of areas that we would call poverty by the system we use, free and reduced lunch, as compared to only 20% of the districts. And this is across the board, and it impacts many of the children of color. The situations in which some of these kids are coming from, what their education academic realm depends on, started years before they ever walked into any school door. And we are really working with symptoms. We are working after the fact. We can do a lot after the fact, but we cannot solve the problem. So I would emphasize that, and I'll probably emphasize it till I die. But that's important.
Thank you. I, from my experience, I would agree with that, although I think it does, we still have to do what we can to make efforts to move those students along who we work with. Anything else? Okay. I will, you'll hear more about when our next meeting will be, as I said at the beginning. Okay, so I'll adjourn the work group at this time.